The next case is 07640, Randall J. Dome versus Urine America, Inc. Mr. Penny.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Todd Penny on behalf of Urand Incorporated. Your Honors, this case brings to you again an opportunity to review the boundaries of the wrongful discharge in violation of public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine. It's an issue that's been before you in other cases within the last year, and it's an area that's still very active in the practice of law of employment lawyers, both from the plaintiff's side as well as the defense side. Specifically at issue in this case is the jeopardy element of that cause of action. Where is the line drawn? The Second District Court of Appeals basically, in our opinion, overstepped the line in two areas. First, regarding to whom a protected complaint can be made. The case is sort of a common law whistleblower claim. And the issue, one of the issues before you is, well, to whom can these common law whistleblowing reports be made? The second issue that's before you is, what is the substance of these complaints? What is required to be said by the employee before the protections are triggered? The Second District found that there would be protection for conversations with a third-party independent insurance appraiser, someone who was coming into the facility to simply give an estimate on what they would charge to insure the facility. The Second District also said that the employee's intent in making the complaint was irrelevant, and the words said are largely irrelevant because the record is very clear in this case that the employee did not mention safety, which was the public policy that was purportedly being advanced. Addressing the issue of to whom a protected complaint could be made, there was no precedent, either from this court, from the appellate courts of the state, or from the federal court system that had ever recognized a cause of action for whistleblowing when the complaint was made outside of two contexts, either to any government agency that had the authority to come in and rectify the concern, or to upper level management. The courts, both in this state as well as the federal court system, always recognized that, well, if you complain to the government, we're not going to let your employer terminate you because of that, even if you're wrong. Even if you were mistaken in your belief that illegal activity was occurring, we're not going to let the employer terminate you. We're also going to protect you if you go to upper level management and say, hey, I have these concerns, could you please fix them? We discourage that. But the Second District went outside of those two contexts and said, you know what, we're going to recognize it when there are independent market forces in play that could eventually advance workplace safety. And their analysis went so far as to say, well, the insurance company could then possibly charge higher premiums, and the employer would have to choose between paying these higher premiums and letting the unsafe work condition exist. But that's a very slippery slope to head down in the employment context. Does that rule of law apply to spousal conversations? If I complain to my spouse that the workplace is unsafe, is that protected? Well, it's not hard to imagine a hypothetical where that conversation could advance workplace safety eventually. If the spouse goes someplace, talks to her friend, her friend's married to the president, all sorts of third-party extrapolations from the logic applied by the Second District. Does it apply to neighbors? Does it apply when you complain to a city council member who may be influential? Does it apply when you complain to vendors? It's a very imprecise rule of law adopted by the Second District. And the imprecision is reflected in the amicus brief. As I highlighted in my reply brief, the amicus had a difficult time even articulating what standard they thought ought to apply because this is such an amorphous rule. The court has in the past found protection when you complain to the government. The court has in the past found protection when you complain to your employer, but there was a bright line drawn there. There's never been recognized any protections outside of that. And the Second District seemed to feel compelled to do that based on this court's decision in the Putlinski case. But in reality, that rule of law was not expressed in the Putlinski case. That case involved an internal complaint to management, and the portion cited relied on Kulch, which was a complaint to OSHA. It was clearly dicta. It was in a footnote. And Justice Cook went at length in the concurring opinion to point that out, that that was not the rule of law of the case. The only thing that was actually at issue in the case when accepted was what statute of limitations we were going to apply. And the only rules of law that came out in the syllabus was the statute of limitations and the clarity element. There was no discussion of the jeopardy element, and it wasn't part of that. Public policy also suggests that the rules proposed by the defendants in this case should be applied. We need a system for our employers in the state of Ohio that has some certainty to it, that lays out concretely what it is we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to behave. This rule of law is just going to invite litigation amongst employers and employees. And there are 59 federal statutes alone that have anti-retaliation provisions. This is supposed to be a limited exception that fills the gaps where other protections aren't available. That's what the court has said repeatedly, most recently in the Leininger case. This is not a limited exception. If the Second District decision stands, it's anything but limited. It applies open-endedly to nearly every third-party conversation.
Counsel, the information that this employee passed on to, it was an inspector for the insurance company, is that?
An auditor, an appraiser. He was going to give a bid to sell us insurance products.
Okay. And was it false information?
Actually, it wasn't much information at all. If you read the testimony of the employee on what he said in the conversation, he had been in a long-running dispute with his supervisor, and he brought it to his attention that, hey, they removed this. They're trying to make me look like I'm not doing my job, and they're trying to get rid of me. And that's all that was said. The word safety, the word fire, the word concern wasn't there. The only thing he testified was that he was concerned he was being set up to be terminated, and he was trying to prevent that by telling this guy, hey, you got to find out what happened to this inspection. It was an automated system that tracked dockets, basically. And he was pointing out that something that was on the docket that he was supposed to have done had not been done.
But
and
counsel,
that's what the record says.
That's a self-serving motivation on his part, correct?
For sure.
Okay. And the insurance auditor, the person that was going to be doing a bid, was he in any position to do anything about this information?
No, in fact, he did nothing about it, except sort of chuckle and wonder why he was accosted in the entranceway of the facility. But no, that's sort of our point on the flaw in the Second District's analysis. The person to whom he's complaining had no ability to immediately, directly, or any time in the foreseeable future cause any change to occur, unlike the government or unlike a supervisor.
And the basic rationale for his termination was, insubordination?
Yeah, he'd yet again violated a directive. There is something that's really not part of this case, but it's been argued in the briefs that's worth noting, Your Honors. There was some speculation by the Second District, well, there must be something sinister going on when you tell employees not to talk to the insurance adjuster. And I think if you read the record as a whole, the record is devoid of that. In reality, what happens, Urand is an FDA-regulated pharmaceutical company. They're inspected, audited, reviewed constantly. And so they had set up a formalized process so that when any people came in, they were assigned people who actually knew the answers to their questions and said, deal with these people. There was no hiding going on. In fact, the record reflects that there was another inspection just a month before that for fire safety. So it's really not a case where A, there was a concern, or B, he expressed a concern to anyone who was capable of remedying the situation.
Counsel, if anything, does the record indicate the insurance inspector did with, and I'm not quite sure what information he got, but did the insurance, is there any indication in the record what the insurance inspector did?
Not in the record, Your Honor. Outside of the record, he did nothing. But in the record, if you're looking for a citation in there to what happened from there, the record is neutral on that.
This case obviously is an opportunity for us to try to write a rule of law on the issues presented. I take it the restatement of torts doesn't help us with this.
It does right? not, Your Honor. And I've done extensive research on other jurisdictions, and quite honestly, this is a novel theory because it's not whistleblowing if you're not blowing the whistle to someone
well,
who has some authority.
Yeah, that's what I want to ask you. Someone. Your proposition of law is very limited in to whom the information has to be given by the employee. Wouldn't it be better to write a rule of law that would not confine it to a governmental agency or a supervisory person or supervisor in the company, but you know, the employer, but some to broaden it to say that it has to be made to someone who can do something about the complaint, has the authority, with the words I just meant to fill in, but someone who has the authority. The argument here is, of course, that the insurance investigator or whatever he was didn't have any authority to do anything about the complaint. He could have passed it along, but that wouldn't have given him any authority to do anything. But why shouldn't the test be a little broader than what you suggested to us?
I think two reasons. First of all, I'm not sure who else has that authority to immediately or directly affect a change.
Could be a coworker. Could be, you can think up an example where a coworker might have the authority to make a change, but is not a supervisor.
I would suspect, Your Honor, that would be rare factually.
It's rare, but we're talking about a legal test here that
right.
that would apply in any case that's filed.
Well, I think the other problem with that approach, Your Honor, is again, it's one that creates instability rather than stability in this area of law that has been largely unstable since its creation. Then you're inviting litigation. Well, does this coworker really have the authority to change something, or did he reasonably believe he had the authority? By drawing a bright line around management, clearly for a number of places under the law, managers are charged with responsibility to act on behalf of the company. In sexual harassment areas, there's different rules for managers. Under the National Labor Relations Act, there's different rules for managers. It's not uncommon to have managers held to a higher standard, so this would be a consistent rule of law. I think any test that leaves it in the open of, well, could this person or couldn't have, is going to invite more litigation, more speculation, and more problems in sort of maintaining the balance in the workplace that employers need to survive. Your Honor, I failed to ask on the front end, but I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, which is about what I have left.
Yeah, minutes and 4 seconds remaining.
I will sit down and resume in 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Penny. Mr. Gittes.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it please the court. This court has a workable, well-known standard for evaluating wrongful discharge claims, and the facts of this case are appropriate for this complaint to proceed. Since 1994, when this court and Painter first adopted the four elements of the Parrott test, that there's a clarity element, which is a legal issue, that is, there is a public policy based on statutional, constitutional, administrative, or common law. Secondly, a jeopardy element, that the employer's dismissal or adverse conduct under the circumstances impedes, interferes, or hampers with that public policy. That there's causation, which is a fact question for the jury, that it was actually motivated by the protected activity. And lastly, of course, whether there's a balance or some overriding business justification. The defendants in this case are asking you now, 14 years later, well, 13 years later in terms of Collins versus Rinscana, when you officially adopted that standard, and have applied it in every single wrongful discharge case, common law, public policy case that's come before this court over and over again. They're asking you to change it. They're asking you to adopt a per se rule that if you complain to a third private party, an outside third private party, no matter what the policy is, no matter what the circumstances are, it doesn't count. Well, that's not Parrott's rule. Parrott's rule, which this court referred to in the Pitolinsky case, yes, it's a footnote, but they discussed it. Parrott never said that. And contrary to what counsel just told you, there are cases around the country where out reports to third-party private people, for example, a union. The Brockle case, where they wrote to an international union about a situation, and the goal was to get them to pressure the local to deal with abuses going on by the workers. There's another case, actually that's a Letgutko case, the Brockle case, dealing with a police officer going to another individual. I mean, they were a police officer, but they had no direct authority, weren't connected to the employer or even that jurisdiction, about a stolen test. There are other examples. Common sense that suggests to this court that the proposed rule by the defendants makes no sense, especially when we're dealing with one of the most famous reasons that we have regulations of safety in the first place. This is about fires. It was the Triangle Waist Shirt Fire in New York that started the modern era of workplace safety regulations, and one only has to think about the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire not so many years ago to think about how the consequences are. Now, let's take some obvious examples outside the context of this case. Let's say you have a subcontractor, an employee of a subcontractor working on a nuclear power plant, who goes to the plant, the private plant owner, a utility company, and says, by the way, your contractor is doing things that will cause a nuclear explosion. They're not putting in the right materials or whatever it is. That's reporting to an outside third party, private party. Are we going to allow that dismissal under Parrott standards? Does it not jeopardize public safety in an extraordinary way? Obviously, the power plant owner has some authority to deal with it, or at least can reasonably be believed to have authority to deal with it. One other example that's especially in light of today's headlines would be appropriate. Let's say you have a local poultry producer who's got contaminated chicken. They've been shipped out already. An employee who is aware of it realizes that he's done this despite the knowledge that there's serious health death risk. They pick up and start calling some restaurants saying, by the way, you've got contaminated chicken delivered. They're fired immediately for not following the chain of command. And under the rule proposed by the defendants, there is no remedy for them, although they may have saved lives. Now, the facts of this case, I suggest to you, are not as strained as being suggested. They're rather extraordinary. First of all, Mr. Dome worked for this company a very short time, yet there were two fires in his short tenure. He was hospitalized because of smoke inhalation for the first one in August of 2001. Then in February of 2002, there was another fire. He wasn't involved directly at the time because a pump had a diaphragm leak causing atomization of a agent that was used in the process, and because there wasn't proper venting, despite manufacturer's instructions, there was a fire. Following that, as is alluded to in the Court of Appeals decision, and I urge you to take a look at Defendant's Exhibit I, attached to the plaintiff's deposition, a letter that the defendant's counsel brought up and questioned Mr. Domi about, where he contemporaneously is writing at the time, June 2002, about what is going on and about some of the discussions that were going on about this whole fire and the pump issue and the venting. He says in his deposition he was satisfied with the progress ultimately that was made, but that progress occurred in the context of his complaining to a local fire captain who came in and did inspections and having disagreements with Bert Cruz, his supervisor, who at one point called him a troublemaker, if you take a look at this letter, which was authenticated by him in his deposition. And by the way, what happens, and he talks about his sleepless nights, how he's told he shouldn't tell anybody about this, it speaks for itself. But the Court of Appeals and his own affidavit allude to the fact there's a history here. And what happens? He is demoted effectively supervisory duties are taken away. There's a factual dispute about what the reason was. This is all happening right on top of these safety issues and a second fire. A man who himself had to go to the hospital because the first one, because an alarm system didn't work.
Mr. Geddes, if I could turn you to the rule of law that we're looking at here in trying to break down the jeopardy element. You're correct. The four statements now, the first two are a matter of the court, a matter of law for the court to rule on, the clarity element and then the jeopardy element. Why should we not be more specific in defining the jeopardy element for courts that must decide on summary judgment motions whether, as a matter of law, jeopardy exists and that public policy would be jeopardized if the individual were discharged in a particular case?
Your Honor, the reason Justice Lanziger, the reason is because it's impossible. I think you have provided extraordinary, useful guidance. You have a clear set of standards, by the way, which, as far as I know, have been almost universally adopted all over the country, federal and state level. There is nowhere I know of, no court has said, per se, going to an outside private third party in all circumstances denies you any protection. There is no court. The problem, what Parrott wrote about and why this court adopted it, is because the factual circumstances. First of all, what is the policy? I mean, you know, if it's a fire alarm monitoring policy, and there are laws here that say you must monitor the fire alarm system, federal laws and state laws, it's, you know, then the kind of thing the employer does and the kind of communications the employee makes are maybe different than if the policy is, let's say, making reports to police departments, criminal reports, because obviously when is a criminal, who you can communicate criminal information to or believed criminal information, good faith, may be different, the scope of the protection, you know, whether you can go to certain private third parties when it's a criminal issue may be very different than if it's an insurance person, who I hope I have a chance to get to, if it's a fire alarm issue. These are very fact-specific cases. This floodgate argument, I mean, you all have been involved with this court for varying years. Isn't it interesting that this is the first case you've had in 14 years since this has been adopted that presented the issue of what about going to a third private outside party? If there are all these hundreds and thousands of lawsuits where we're stretching everything beyond recognition, why is this the very first case? Why are there only a handful statewide of Court of Appeals decisions that even address this issue about a private third party? But the short answer, I apologize, is it's impossible to do. You have a good working set of standards, and it depends on the policy and the circumstances. Now, here I suggest the deputy element is clearly involved. I mean, look, this gentleman was fired 2 days after he walked up to an insurance person who would have the power to recommend they can't get insurance, which I suggest to you is the marketplaces, as the Second District pointed out, a powerful tool to get compliance with safety regulations. And he knew who he was and understood he was a representative of the insurance inspecting the place. He went up to him and said, by the way, he told him, I have responsibilities for fire test alarm system. I run the computers. This is in his testimony. Hands him a document that he tells him indicates that the fire alarm tests for January and February were overdue, and in March isn't there.
I thought on that, on the last point, that I thought his complaint was, or his concern was, that the test had been, he was going to be accused of not having the test, having that piece of paper in the report, and that it didn't go to really to the safety issue.
That's a highly disputed issue in this case. His affidavit indicates, if you read his letter, if you read his testimony, it is not clear that was his sole motive. It was a motive. He was concerned about being blamed for it. Absolutely. Why wouldn't he be? But as in all discrimination cases and common, you can have multiple motivations. And as Parrott points out, and as this court pointed out in the Fox case, the issue isn't his motive. The issue is, did he communicate information relevant to a safety issue? And under the federal law that applies, a failure to monitor is a serious safety issue. Why is the system that's supposed to be making sure the alarms are being tested and work having missing reports not an automatic issue? And what did he say to the guy? He testified, I said, you should check this out. Now, he may be wanting to protect himself and protect coworkers. And if you take a look at Exhibit A, you'll see protection of coworkers was always on his mind during his tenure there.
Mr. Geddes, could you help connect the dots for me here as a contextual matter on the communication that he did give the insurance adjuster and how that implicated workplace safety? Because I'm not quite sure, and maybe the record doesn't reflect, what was in that report other than there were tests that were done that were missing. Is the implication or the express communication is that the tests were done and the alarms failed, or is it just the test isn't there?
Your Honor, as he testified, in and of itself, absent information about information indicating tests aren't timely or that they're missing is a safety issue by itself, because federal law specifically requires it. The whole purpose of that monitoring system is to make sure that what happened to him in August of 2001 doesn't happen again, when he pushed an alarm button and it didn't work, and he had to run way across to another location, in the meanwhile, inhaling lots of smoke. And so, Your Honor, he said, I didn't tell him that it wasn't done, or that it was a bad test, or that it was done. I just wanted him to know that these things weren't being done as required. That's basically what he said.
The state of the record developed to such to determine whether those tests or the records of the tests were available, or were they absolutely missing from then on?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer. And I will submit to you, I agree, and I think Mr. Duell would not criticize me for saying the factual record in this case is not as developed as it might be, and especially if this court was considering creating a new kind of standard. But Your Honor, in the little time I have, if it pleases the court, I really want to stress one thing. The notion that Mr. Domey was fired because he talked, merely because he talked, greeted, as he puts it, confronted, as put by the defendants, that insurance inspector, is silly. You know, if he'd gone downstairs and talked to him about last Sunday's Super Bowl, we wouldn't be here today, and everybody here knows that. He was fired because he had a history of raising concerns, as is alluded to in the Second District Court, when they would talk about his complaints to the local fire captain and other expressions of safety concerns, because he handed him a document that had serious safety implications. There is no evidence in the record that I'm aware of that this was a firing offense, merely talking to him. I know chain of command rules are there, but there are lots of cases around the country, and they're alluded to in the amicus brief, where in some cases, chain of command rules are viewed as a violation of the law themselves if they are used to interfere with people's ability to tell somebody who might have authority to prevent loss of life or a dangerous situation. And lastly, there is no question that this court is going to have a case to identify an appropriate private third party to whom a complaint can be made. One of those examples, besides the ones I gave you at the beginning of our talk today, or the questioning, is an insurance company. It is one of the most powerful institutions in the private marketplace to get compliance with safety. They've got the power to prevent a business from operating by denying insurance. Of course, an insurance carrier, if the marketplace is going to be a regulator, in addition to the government, you can't pick a more appropriate vehicle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Geddes. Mr. Penny, you saved 2 minutes of your time.
I think there's a fundamental disconnect here. We're not asking that the four-element cause of action be modified in any way. The Sixth Circuit wrote twice that it doesn't know what it means in Ohio, the jeopardy element. That's all we're asking. We're not asking that parent standards be abandoned or tossed to the side or modified. We're asking the court to tell the employers and the employees of Ohio, frankly, what it means. Tell the Sixth Circuit what it means, because right now we don't know. So the thought that Parrott has this beautiful model up there, please don't mess with it, we agree. You don't need to mess with it. Just tell us what the jeopardy element means. As far as what we do know it means from decisions of this court, we do know that if there's available statutory remedies, this limited cause of action doesn't exist. So the hypotheticals about, well, he talked to the union, well, that's covered by the National Labor Relations Act. And what about the nuclear complaint? Well, the nuclear regulatory statutes have anti-retaliation provisions. We don't need those there. That's not what this case is about. And the cases cited by the amicus in their brief, frankly, all are statutory cases because zero cases exist that extend the common law cause of action this far. I'd also urge you, take a look at the entire record. I quoted Mr. Dome's testimony in my brief. I'm not extrapolating, but what I can tell you is there's 299 pages of testimony, and the 2001 fire was never mentioned. Not a single time. It's also not in the complaint. It was only in an affidavit filing the motion for summary judgment where he said, oh, by the way, I had this concern way back in 2001, and I realized 3 years have passed, but that was really my motivation, although I didn't tell him that. That's not what this case is about either. This case is about, do you have to say what you mean what you say, and to whom do you have to say it? And we request that the Court of Appeals be reversed, the trial court entry of summary judgment be reinstated, and the propositions of law that we put in our brief be adopted by this court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Penny. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.